You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's more of a bong instead of a bing. You know?
We got highly technical there for a second, and then you ruined it.
Yes.
Welcome to Inside the Banjoverse with me, your host, Enda Scahill. I've been playing a Neckfull banjo on stage for the last 5 or 6 years, and anyone who has seen Wee Banjo 3 in that time will surely recognize the instrument. And my guest today is none other than the maker himself, Tom Neckfull, originally from Minneapolis in Minnesota, and now residing in Sisters, Oregon, a town that I have a great fondness for. I have played there and also spent a week fishing there last summer with my good friends, Kristen and Dan. So I do hope you enjoy this quite technical, fascinating, interesting, quirky, and enjoyable interview with the great Tom Neckfull.
So where are you right now?
Well, I'm in Sisters, Oregon, and looking out on the snow, and it's a beautiful day.
You're going to have snow there for quite a while, right?
Well, you know, this climate is pretty mild compared to Minnesota, where I grew up. It's pretty much, it melts off pretty fast here, you know. It gets pretty, and then it melts, and then it comes back again, you know. It's pretty nice.
So, I mean, let's start at the very beginning. You're a renowned banjo maker. And I think renowned maybe is a curious experimenter as much as anything else. But I really want to know, you know, let's go right back to the start of the story. When did you discover banjo? When did you decide you liked it? Were you a musician first or a builder first? How did that all come about?
Oh, yeah. Well, good. It's fun. I really resonate with the banjo, and I always have. I think I was in my mid-teens when I first started getting interested in the banjo. One of the first things a young person does, you know, when they're a teenager, 15, 16, is you want to exert your independence, you know. And my sister was bringing home some folky, you know, folk albums and maybe an occasional bluegrass or that kind of, it was music that I hadn't really heard before, and I was fascinated by it, and decided to go out and buy a banjo with my own money. It was paper route money, as I remember, and I bought a banjo, and it sat in my bedroom, you know, for a couple of years while every time I picked it up, I got frustrated. And one day
do you know what kind of banjo it was? Do you remember?
Oh yeah. Yeah. It was called a Bentley, a Japanese made banjo. It was pretty basic, aluminum body. You know, I think we've all seen and had those banjos early on. They're endlessly adjustable, but, they don't sound too good. And then I ended up eventually I stumbled into being able to play. It was almost an accident. I was trying to play and my fingers got so mixed up that I just kind of flew my fingers at the banjo and accidentally hit a couple notes along with the recording And it inspired me to continue the process and really get serious, you know, and go through that Earl Scruggs book and learn the licks one by one. And I still feel like I'm a student, always challenged by this instrument. And I love it. It's just awesome.
For the, we'll say, the non-banjo players, and also for the Irish banjo players who might listen to this, you explain what a lick is and how it, because in Irish music, we just learn a tune and there are no licks. So I'm curious
So for a bluegrass player, you're playing music in little chunks called rolls. Or licks, yes, that a lick could be a roll or it could be a combination of rolls. It could be a memorized group of notes that you play and plug in to various situations where they fit. And I think that that's a characteristic of bluegrass, is that you play with memorized rolls that fit in mathematically perfectly into those slots of the measures. And you can mix and match your vocabulary of rolls and licks to suit the occasion. And I think the better musician you are, the more that you just learn the tune. But as we all know, the banjo has somewhat of a shortened sustain, and the note on the banjo often calls for many notes instead of just one. You know, to fill in a slower song or a longer passage, you fill it in with a flurry of notes quite often. And that's what the function of a lick is. It'll be sometimes referred to as a fill-in lick on a whole note. For example, you just don't play duh, you go da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So I've got my bag of licks and bag of tricks that I do. And I think everyone has a signature sort of in their sound coming from their bag of tricks and their licks. So that's what I do. And I try to stretch the boundaries of what I play all the time, trying to do more things like you guys, always entertaining and always surprising the listener. You guys are one of my favorite groups for sheer listening enjoyment.
Thank you, Tom. I was thinking that what other instruments might describe the banjo as a flurry of notes instead of one?
Yeah. I suppose there are other instruments like that, but I don't know what they are. Drums, kind of.
they have fiddles, for sure.
Fiddles,
Are licks identifiable? Like, if you heard somebody playing and they did a lick, and you'd say, well, there's a J.D. Crow lick, there's a Earl Scruggs
lick. Yes, absolutely. And I have a bit of a pet peeve about licks, because there are cliche licks, and those that you hear every time you hear a bluegrass recording. And on one hand, those are licks that define the genre of music, and they're traditionally based, and they've come to be known as bluegrass sounds. And as you know, I've always been sort of a rebel when it comes to following the dictates of a specific formula. And I have a feeling that, you know, music should be as original as you can make it in order to put your own stamp on the music. And so I try to avoid the licks that I hear everybody else playing. Although I do have to echo those licks in ways that come across as sounding like bluegrass when I'm playing a bluegrass song. So It's a fine balance. To be original sounding is something that I strive for, but at the same time, it can alienate you if you're playing in a real traditional setting. I wonder if that goes for Irish music too. I mean,
That was exactly what I was thinking, is that, and I was going to ask, are there modernized licks that when you hear them, that they're straying outside of the boundaries of what would be considered strictly traditional? And I mean, that's a crazy debate. Like, what does that even mean? What's traditional? Do we bookend it on a certain date and say everything before and after this chapter is not traditional?
Yeah. And I say no boundaries there. You know, when I hear other instruments besides banjo, I guess my ears gravitate to the banjo. But when I hear other instruments playing a wild break, it seems to me like that's accepted on most other instruments to play whatever you can get away with. I think of Tony Rice, for example, as a bluegrass guitarist. He played every note in the book. And a lot of times it was, you know, very jazzy sounding, and adding that element to his music, I think just expanded the realms of bluegrass. It gave permission to other guitar players to go outside of that sort of predictable box that we hear so often. And the banjo seems to get criticized if it goes too far, and people would say, oh, that's not bluegrass anymore, if the lick is too chromatic sounding with half steps between each note and then a big flurry of notes that may not be related to the song can be distracting. And that's where the art of it comes in, I guess, to know when it's appropriate or when it serves the music to do something that is kind of unusual sounding. And it's a continual skill to develop, and to develop your taste as well as your skill and being able to do these things. It's very interesting, because a lot of people will play what they can play, and it may not fit with the music. And I maybe am guilty of that occasionally. If I learn a new lick, I'll strive to put it into a song somewhere, even if there's no real compelling reason to do it.
But I mean, surely Bela, and I'm thinking of Noam Pekelny, like the music that they play, you know, goes so far outside of the realms of strictly traditional music. I mean, they must be bringing the role of the banjo and broadening it on the way.
Oh yeah,
the stage.
They are. And there's just a super technical skill that has been developed. It's so hard to play at the speeds that we try to play at, and to get the notes correct, and to avoid just falling apart and having mistakes. So the attempt to do things like they're doing is, well, it's futile for me, really, to be quite honest. I can't play at the same level of musicianship that those guys can play, but I can find my own little stamp on the music. I can find my own little sounds that work that may not be commonly heard in other people's music. And that's what I'm looking for in my music. And when it comes to expanding the realm, yes, those guys are doing that. But I would say that it would be difficult to expect, you know, like human beings, normal humans, to achieve that high level of superhuman ability that they can throw out on their instruments. So I'm continually amazed when I listen to those guys.
There's quite a lot of that happening in bluegrass music. If you think of the phenomenal mandolin players and, you know, even the fiddle.
I
immediately think of Sierra Hall and Chris Thiele, like technically mind-blowing musicians.
Technically, yes. Now, do you play with mostly a flat pick, or all a flat pick?
Yeah, only ever.
Only,
Yeah, flat pick only.
Okay, yeah. And that is something that is mind blowing, because you get so many notes, you know, from from one plectrum. It's like I've got three plectrums basically on three fingers, and can't do the speed that you can do with one flat pick. It's amazing.
So, how long are you building banjos?
Building banjos, I started in the mid 1980s, and my first banjo was that I built was a copy of a Mastertone type banjo, and a friend of mine had a few components that he was working on, and he kind of he had done some artwork and inlay on this neck. So I adopted the neck from him and finished the job and did all of the technical tone components, you know, and fit the neck to the body and learned all about how a banjo is made. I got a lot of help from Bill Sullivan at a company called First Quality Instrument Supplies. They were in Louisville, Kentucky back then, and Bill was real helpful at, you know, giving me some professional pointers, you know, what you do when you're building a banjo. And he's the guy that really was involved in building a lot of the banjo parts for Gibson banjos when they kind of were resurrected and came back with high quality banjos in the 80s. And so I had some connection right with the country's best banjo builders. And I was talking to Gibson, I was talking to Deering, I was developing my ideas and trying to kind of show the world what I had. And they were definitely interested, but I never connected with any of the other banjo builders.
So I'm curious, most banjo players don't build banjos, right? I've never built it. I've never felt compelled to build a banjo. I even wonder if I have found the perfect banjo to play. So what made you want to build it?
Yeah, this was part of my growing up experience. As I was approaching 30 years old, I was looking at the things that really excited me in my life, and I was trying to develop an actual career path for myself. And while I liked playing, I didn't have a particular unusual talent at that, and I didn't think it was practical for me to go out and become a banjo musician solely. But I did want the banjo to be a big part of my life. And in other parts of my life, I'd always liked design and inventing things and trying to be creative and artistic. And so I put my love of the banjo with my love of design and became a banjo designer. Those two words, banjo and design, were the result of like a self-study that I made with a workbook. I think it was called The Adventurers. And it's a way to figure out what you're going to do in your career path. And so I followed the directions in this career book,
Can't imagine the people that wrote the book had any notion that Banjo Maker would be at the end of the process.
No. It was an open-ended book. It could be, a tire salesman or a snow shoveler or something. But the answer at that end of that book was not, it was not encouraging, because I look at my life as, you know, with the future of building banjos, and it does not look very lucrative. And so I had one caveat, and that was, well, if and only if I could come up with a banjo idea that was completely original, that would fit within the realm of banjo, but would be totally heads and tails, new design above what is available now and better. Well, then I would divert my life towards banjo design and building. And I had not a clue of what I was going to do with the banjo to make it, you know, like really fantastic. But I did realize through the process of building my first banjo that there were a lot of idiosyncrasies and problems with the instrument. And if you could get rid of all of those damn parts, the hooks and the nuts and the rods and the hoops, and somehow simplify the function of a banjo, it would be fantastic. And maybe I could make a living on a design like that. Well, I didn't know what it was, but a friend of mine named Sam suggested that I screw the head on to a banjo like the cap of a jar. And if you can think of a mayonnaise cap or a peanut butter jar, you know, and it's got the threads that are all around the outside, could you do that with a banjo head? And so the first thought was, well, you can't really screw on a banjo head, but maybe you could screw something else that would make the pressure on the head work. So the thought bounced around my head for a day or two, and I came up with the Gila mount design, which is the helical mounting of the tone ring and head into the frame of the banjo, and then the jar type thread is actually on a flange that screws into from the back of the banjo, holding all the rest of the components in place. So I was fascinated then, just from the very onset of the idea, thinking this is it. Now if I can go get a lathe, you know, I knew the kind of machine I needed to make the parts. If I could have a lathe, if I could make a cast aluminum piece big enough to machine, maybe I could make a prototype myself. And so I did that. I went out and went to machinery auctions, and I found a lathe that was big enough to turn a banjo rim on. The rim is inside the banjo, and then the frame, I call it, is the metal outside of the banjo. But I was able to come up with prototypes. My first one was only 8 inches diameter, and then I made a 11-inch banjo, which is the standard size that most of us use. And the first one was very resophonic and very dark sounding, because there was no openings in the side of this banjo. It looked kind of like a hubcap with no voids or nothing really to let the sound out. And so I kind of cut away parts of the casting, allowing sound to sort of come in and out of the instrument. And it began sounding more and more like a banjo. And in fact, it had a deeper, more sort of resonant quality that I thought needed to be, explored further. So I just never stopped. I came up with a prototype that looked good.
So did you understand the science behind why it sounded deeper and more resonant? Or was that something that you figured out later on?
It was intuitive at first. I think that the intuition that I had about removing structural components that are holding tightly onto the tone ring and rim, as you release them and let them just freely float in the structure of the banjo, there would be a tendency to sound less tinny, less bright. There'd be more a deeper quality ability for the components to resonate more fully without being impinged or impeded by the many connections of metal parts that are in a normal banjo.
Is that the reason that you use a ball bearing tone ring?
Well, yeah, there's so many. That's a good question. The ball bearings are used as a anti-friction device, because when you're tightening this banjo. You have a turning motion going on inside of the instrument. Without the ball bearings, you need another surface which the parts would slide upon one another. And, you know, I've used Teflon as a interface, a low friction interface, and that works nicely, but it's a little bit difficult under high pressure of the head. When you get it up to playing tension, it's very difficult to tighten it using the Teflon ring. So I had a brainstorm one day and decided to throw a bunch of parts back into the banjo. I had taken about 80 parts out of the banjo by designing the Gila mount. And when I went to the 80 ball bearings, it's like I'm putting parts back in, but their function was really to isolate the tone ring, to allow it to rest upon the ball bearings and resonate without being impinged by a lot of connections to metal parts. But then there's those 80 metal parts that the tone ring is sitting on. But if you can imagine like a bell, it's just sort of suspended on these little points of the ball bearings and able to really do its musical job without any interference from other non-musical parts that are just designed to as hardware, basically. So I think we've separated the structural parts from the musical parts and allowed the musical parts to do their job without, you know, without mucking up the waters with the parts that were just designed to mechanically hold the instrument together.
So on my banjo, there are some steel ball bearings, I guess, and some white marble ones. Is that a tonal thing as well?
Kind of an aesthetic thing. We have three different kinds of ball bearings that we typically use. Some of them are white plastic, and they're almost like just fillers or space taker uppers that we put between the metal balls. You wouldn't want to use the plastic ones in too big of a number, because they might sort of absorb some of the vibrations of the instrument and cause a less brilliant sound. So I like to use the hard ball bearings, which would be the steel ones. And then for lighter weight and keeping the banjo to a minimum, to a more comfortable weight, you can use ceramic ball bearings. And so I frankly don't remember what's in yours, but I think it's steel and maybe some Delrin. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's just balancing the weight. And if you put in all steel ball bearings, it's a fantastic sound, and it maybe adds a few more ounces of weight. But generally speaking, our banjos are not overly heavy, and we have options that make them, you know, extraordinarily light as well, mm-hmm. depending on what tone ring you use.
So talk to me then about head choice. But, you know, you went okay. for flat versus arched.
Head choice. You mean that's the drum part, the flexible membrane on the top of the head, top of the banjo.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, the years ago, people would use skin. They like, what is it, calf skin or goat skin for the banjo head. And occasionally you still see those natural skin heads. And that has an organic, maybe different tonality, and so some people are still interested in that sound. And it's possible with the neck fill design to use the original calfskin heads, and you can mount your own in a neck fill and make that work very easily. But the typical head is made of mylar plastic, which is a type of polyester. You can't tear it or rip it. It's very, very strong. and of course it reaches its yield point at some point. You can break a banjo head, and I think as a banjo player, we've all experienced weird sounds, and then finding a saggy spot in our head, we found that we busted a head and have to change it. Well, the neck fill banjo has a system of tightening the head that puts even tension all the way around on the head. And so if you tighten it and over tighten it, it would be possible to break a head, but you never really do, because that perfect tension is coming down evenly all the way around at the same time. And usually the head is broken by shearing like one point of the head too tightly through over tightening one of the lugs that would be on a traditional banjo. But yeah, there's just aesthetic choices, and there are different sounds from different thicknesses of heads. And it's also a nice billboard. You could put a color or a message or something on your banjo head and not ruin the value of the instrument, or, you know, it's a nice exchangeable surface that you can really try different heads just for fun. I like taking those Renaissance heads, which are kind of translucent, and painting the underside with little swatches of spray paint. And I think I did that to your banjo, and you have more of a interesting pattern that looks kind of like maybe a old leather head that has been worn out or weathered somehow.
A bit like my own head, worn out, yeah. And weathered.
Yeah, exactly.
Have you a preference then tonally? Because we'll say your quintessential white banjo head versus Renaissance versus frosted versus clear.
Yeah, I do. I change my mind a lot because it's easy to change a head in a neck fill, and it's easy to change a head in a regular banjo. It just takes a little longer. But I will typically use a white head for all of my bluegrass banjos, and just to not rock the boat. And there's enough design differences and differences in appearance that I don't want to make the banjo completely unrecognizable as a banjo when I'm in a bluegrass situation. So I will use the white head in the bluegrass situations, usually frosted on the top for bluegrass, because that keeps your banjo bridge without slipping around a lot. Frosting on the bottom of the head gives you a similar sound, but less noise from your fingers accidentally like rubbing on the head. And so maybe, is it true that the four string banjos are typically smooth top heads?
Typically. Yeah, because of course, with Irish banjo, the traditional sound was that kind of high pitched pingy sound. So yeah. You would get that with an arch top resonator, and generally the white head. But there's more frosted heads coming in now, and even some Renaissance. And I think part of it is kind of that the trend has moved to maybe a softer sounding banjo or a more kind of warmer sounding banjo.
Ah, interesting. Yeah, it seems that you lose some of that cutting power when it's a warmer sound. Like maybe it wouldn't be as loud in a session.
That's not might necessarily be a bad thing. I mean, the banjo can be very cutting.
Yeah, and so it's another I guess musical choice. Excuse me. Yeah, it's another musical choice to decide what tone is appropriate for your group of musicians. And I think the format of a neck fill banjo is a little more conducive to adapting, I should say, to your own tone. You can be very loud and cutting by just simply using that clear head and tightening the head to its maximum. And then the banjo bridge is a critical component that makes a huge difference in the tone and cutting power of a banjo. So
explain a little bit about that, Tom, as well, because I mean, that's a whole new area for me, was even looking at different types of bridges. And I changed out the bridge that you put on my banjo. Silvio Ferretti in I asked Russ Carson, Russ that plays with Ricky Skaggs. I just sent him a text one day and I said, "What's the best bridge?" And he just texted me back, "Silvio Ferretti." And so I sent the measurements to Silvio.
I wonder does Silvio use a special kind of maple or wood?
You're asking the wrong guy. Okay. I do know that the tone was appreciably different. Mm-hmm. And I would have been skeptical enough, not knowing enough about bridges. I would have said, surely, you know, unless you're doing bone or bone insert, I wouldn't have noticed the difference. But I would have noticed it appreciably warmer tone.
Yes. And that the warmth of the tone has a lot to do with the weight of the bridge, and also the density of the material that the bridge is made out of. Usually we're talking about hard maple for the main part of the bridge with an ebony top. And that's the traditional way of making a bridge. And the chunkier, heavier bridges will be actually a tone sustainer. It'll be like an inertia mass, I call it. There's a lot of mass in the bridge, which causes the string to vibrate for a longer time, but at a lower amplitude. So you end up with maybe a less cutting sound, but a warmer tone, because it's more of a bong instead of a bing. You know?
We got highly technical there for a second, and then you ruined it.
Yes.
Bong instead actually of a bing. That's an excellent description. More bong instead of bing. That's fantastic.
Yeah, when you talk about sound, it's very hard to put the qualities of sound into descriptive words.
Of course.
And so, and so that's why we have to pick up the instrument and try them and endlessly experiment. And I think we become kind of tinkerers, you know, as well as musicians, and it's part of the fun, but it's also sometimes frustrating if we go somewhere and the weather changes and suddenly our strings are lower to the fingerboard or something like that. We have to know a little bit about it so we can maintain our instruments in a pinch and make sure they're always playable.
Where do you feel that Neckville Banjos as a brand sits in the world of banjo brands? And I'm thinking specifically about somebody who is, let's say, some retired guy who's like, I always wanted to play the banjo. And he knows what a banjo looks like. And Neckville Banjos may not look like what he thinks a banjo looks like. Do you have any insight into what that's like for you trying to sell banjos?
Well, I wish I knew the answer to that, because you've pinpointed probably the biggest challenge for a kind of a freewheeling banjo designer. I don't do anything that is not, proven acoustically. And I'm using the same tone rings that were used back in the 1930s, for example. So the ability to make the exact same sound is there, but I have to qualify that a little bit, because exact same isn't quite the right words to use. I try to find the elements of the sound that are banjo-y and most sought after, and try to leave anything that is negative to the banjo sound, try to leave that to the side or leave it out of the sound. And if you can, for a moment, imagine like the worst sounding banjo in the world, what about that sound would be bad? Would it be a jangliness that the strings are too bright, or would it be a harsh sound, or would it be not in tune, or would it be rattling, you know, against the frets? Those are all kind of unpleasant sounds, but you know, we strive to get all of the things right and leave the things that are wrong out of the equation. And I think by reducing the number of parts in the banjo, we've increased the chances that you're just left with a pure banjo sound, a pure banjo tone, without as much interference from you know, rattly metallic resonances from the hardware that is typically on a banjo. So I think that they're different, and it's hard to explain this to a player that's always played a traditional banjo, and their ear may be accustomed to a slightly more jangly sound. And I think that the neck fills are typically less jangly and very even sounding from the low notes way up high to the very high part of the neck. And so once in the hands of a musician, they become appreciated more and more, especially through the different environments of playing that you would experience as a musician. You know, it's an instrument that grows on people, and they realize the benefits of it, you know, during the time which they own it, which is usually the rest of their lives. They have a dependable instrument. I'm going to name drop now and say Steve Martin.
That was going to be my next question. Drop some names, Tom.
Well, that, you know, the most famous customer I have is probably you, but no, the second most famous. Congratulations on your Steve Martin award, because this is Steve Martin himself has a neck fill banjo. And shortly after he got it, he called me and he said that his neck fill became his number one go-to banjo. Like after one gig, he played it all night at a gig. And he called me and said that was the case. And I was blown away. And I thought it was really amazing to a guy that has just played pre-war banjos and never bought a new banjo before, he adopted mine, and it went right to the top of his list. And I was, you know, totally tickled. And I to this day, I think he still uses that one as one of his main bluegrass banjos, but he does have several that you'll see him with. I forgot where that whole story was leading, and your question was
you were going to drop more names, but I mean, that doesn't get much bigger than Steve Martin, right?
No. And so, of course, you know, you're out there and making a huge difference in the visibility of the neck fill name in Irish music. And there's, I think, a growing number of Irish banjo players. And so we definitely want to let the world know that we're in that business, and we do a lot of custom work for our customers. And, you know, why we are not a big company. We make, you know, less than 200 instruments a year, but they are top quality. And most of them are made specifically for custom orders. And so we try to hit the nail on the head for each customer. They'll give us clues as to how they want it to sound. We will try our best to put all the components together in a way that delivers that result. And we have a pretty good track record of meeting that challenge.
Well, do you get any feedback on the adjustability of the banjo? So from my point of view, being a touring musician, I love the playability, love mm-hmm. the tone. My sound engineer adores it because he did used to sound, you know, he used to engineer an Irish banjo and he had a much harder time with a lot of the overtones and the pinginess. So mm-hmm. I plug in the neck fill and he goes sound check and he goes like, yeah, awesome. It's, you know, just it's completely flat on the desk and that's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
From my point of view, the ease of being able to adjust everything, it's so intuitive. I can pop the back off, tighten the head, you know, go up to elevation. I'm going to have to drop it down because it'll get really tight. I can make adjustments to the neck. I do that all of the time because if I'm somewhere that's really dry, I'm going to have to, you know, let the neck back. If we get into Ohio in the middle of summertime and it's soggy as all get out, I have to tighten the head. And I can do it in minutes as opposed to going around with this key on the drum head.
Yeah, that's right. And I you have me thinking about the effect of weather on a banjo. And the quick adjustment features of the neck fill might be handy in a weather change situation, but most banjos have a truss rod, which would be the most common adjustment in a weather-related change. So changing the tone is easy on a neck fill because of the head tension is so quick and even that that you can, you know, adjust your action in a hurry. And if your neck bows due to humid weather and your strings go close to the fingerboard and it buzzes, yes, you can tighten your head to bring the strings back up. But the best adjustment in that case would be to adjust the bow in the neck so that there's enough bow to allow the strings to come off of the fingerboard. So that's just a decision that, you know, as a repairman and builder, I'm always aware of the causes of the problems. And humidity is a huge culprit when you're traveling. The different barometric pressure and humidity can cause the neck to come in at different shapes. And so I would say first look at the neck in the case of travel, and then go for the tone that you're looking for with your head tension. Normally you don't have to change the head tension if you got it sounding good. But there is another cool thing on the neck fills is that neck adjustment. A lot of people don't like to mess with it because once you get your action right, you know, it's good to go for a long time. But if you change bridges and you want to go to a really high bridge, for example, because your pick might be hitting the head too often and getting more noise, and you want to lift the playing surface away from the head by putting a taller bridge, well, then you can adjust the neck fill neck as a quick adjustment to make your action low again. And so it's easy to play, but you still have the advantages of a high bridge. So, you know, these are all decisions that are not obvious to the beginner or even advanced players sometimes because they haven't had these easy adjustments available in their own banjos. So now it's a whole new world. And even after 30 or 40 years of building, I'd say that the main hurdle and challenge is to get everybody up to speed on what is possible now in the banjo. A lot of the problems that were there are solvable with the neck fill design. And I'm you know, thankful that I can talk about it in these kinds of settings. Yeah.
So I have two final questions. Number one, have you perfected the neck fill design? Are there new features? Is there something that you want to do or you're planning on doing?
There's I think the basic design is perfected. The you know, the frame of the instrument being like a giant nut and the threaded ring being like a giant bolt. That system is well designed. Now it's what we put inside that system, what we put inside of that format that's a wide open field. I think we're just breaking ground on, I mean, we're just at the tip of the iceberg as far as what sort of tone rings work in a banjo. I would like to hear what a glass tone ring sounds like or a ceramic tone ring. There's countless varieties of materials and shapes and ideas that can go in as a tone, you know, tone enhancing or tone making component that we haven't even tried yet. I've used wooden tone rings with metal hoops, titanium. I've used corion, you know, and I'm just fascinated with all of the different possibilities that we have, you know, in the banjo world. And I think what I've done is given the instrument a format that it can use to grow over the coming years. I think we'll see more variety offered in banjos, and a lot of them will be built on the new design. I don't think everybody wants a new banjo, but those that are looking for you know, reliability and pure tone and new sounds, they might be drawn to the Neckville so that they can do a little bit of experimenting and also just be comfortable that they've got a good solid format that's not going to change. It's not going to be unpredictable. There's fewer parts and more reliability. And as Steve said, it was his road warrior banjo. You know, he can trust it and go to it, and it's always there, you know, ready to do the job.
So yeah. Final question. What is there a banjo that you wish you owned? If there was one banjo that you could have, or a brand or a model, is there something that you'd love to have to play?
You know, that's what I do. You know, my job is also fulfilling my own fantasies. The banjo that I want is the one that I'm always working on. And the more I learn about building instruments, the more equipped I am to meet my dream banjo needs. And so, frankly, I don't have a desire to play anybody else's banjo, because I want that banjo to be the product of my own two hands. And I want that instrument to reflect a sound that is really coming from me, not only, you know, in the musical realm, but in the mechanical realm. I just I'm proud of what I've done, and I want to see that banjo is improved and tailored to my own artistic want, you know. So I really have this desire, and I think that I'm working on the latest neck fill that I'm working on is always one for me. And so once I get that banjo done, I will have it available for show and tell and for someone to come along and purchase. And so, I'm on that quest. I'm on that journey, and that banjo is still out there, and it's always a process of improvement.
That's it. I use. That's an awesome answer. I like that.
Well, thank you.
So you have just to wrap up, you've got a workshop in Minneapolis still. I know the two guys up there. And you have a workshop in Sisters.
Right. Yeah, it's nice. I feel like we are expanding and covering the country. We get a lot of business from the Northwest, and our former sales guy, Al Price here, was was really instrumental in building this area up for sales. But I wanted to come out to the Northwest because it's a strong sales area and there's a lot of enthusiasm and there's a lot of great music going on in the Northwest. And so I'm supporting that by being here and doing repair and custom building in our sister's Oregon shop. And then I go back to Minneapolis periodically for the main shop. But my capabilities are growing here, right in Sisters, with the I got a CNC machine and a whole store and an inventory on the walls, and it's really a blast.
Wonderful. Well, I wish you all of the best, and I can't wait to come and visit. I have a real fondness for Sisters. Spent some time there, both playing, and last summer I went up there, fished for 4 or 5 days. I loved it.
Yes,
every minute.
That's cool. Well, I've sure enjoyed the conversation today.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.